Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. You know, when we look back at the grand sweep of human history, there are really very few evolutionary bottlenecks that cast a shadow quite as dark as the Black Death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a defining moment in human biology, really.
Right. I mean, we were talking about an event in the 14th century that wiped out an estimated 30 to 50% of the population in affected regions.
Just staggering numbers. And, you know, whenever an environmental pressure of that sheer magnitude sweeps through a population, the underlying question for geneticists is always, well, about the survivors.
Exactly. Did they simply avoid exposure by pure luck? Or were they harboring hidden microscopic biological advantages?
It's a phenomenal question of natural selection because we're pretty well acquainted with how lethal pathogens act as these massive evolutionary filters.
Right, like a sieve.
Yeah, exactly. When the mortality rate of an untreated infection approaches near total lethality, which pneumonic and septicemic plague often do, any genetic variant that offers even a slight defense gets fiercely selected for in whoever survives.
And we've mapped out some of these genetic defenses for viruses before. Yeah. The classic example that comes to mind is the CCR5 Delta 32 mutation.
Right, the one for HIV.
Yeah, the one that alters a receptor on the surface of T cells and just effectively locks HIV out of the cell. But, you know, viruses are obligate intracellular parasites. They're essentially just genetic code wrapped in a protein coat.
They are entirely dependent on our cellular machinery to do anything.
Exactly. But a bacterium like Yersinia pestis, the causative agent of the plague, that is an entirely different beast.
Oh, completely. It possesses thousands of its own genes, complex secretion systems, the works.
Right. So today we are exploring whether a similar genetic lock and key exists for a sophisticated bacterial pathogen. Like, what if the very immune cells meant to protect you were actually being hijacked as a Trojan horse?
That hypothesis, it completely upends our classical understanding of host-pathogen interactions.
Totally.
If a bacterium can actively hijack the sensory receptors of our immune cells to force its own internalization, I mean, that changes how we view the pathogenesis of historical pandemics, and surprisingly, the mechanics of modern viral infections as well.
It's mind-blowing.
Okay.
And today we celebrate the work of Rachel M. Keener, Dennis C. Coe, and their colleagues at Duke University, the University of Washington, and Miami University, who have advanced our understanding of how human genetic variation influences susceptibility to the plague.
Yes, and this deep dive centers on their recent findings published in the journal Cell Genomics. The paper is titled, Human Genetic Variation Reveals FCRL3 as a Lymphocyte Receptor for Yersinia Pestis, and it was released on September 10th, 2025.
It's a fantastic read.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientific gap they are targeting here is significant. I mean, we have a pretty robust literature detailing how viruses bind to specific human receptors.
We do.
Yeah.
And we also know that bacteria often, you know, manipulate the extracellular environment or use these brute force mechanisms like type 3 secretion systems to just inject toxins.
Right. But mapping the specific naturally occurring human genetic variations that dictate a cell's susceptibility to bacterial entry.
Right.
That has remained incredibly challenging.
Extremely challenging. The difficulty mostly stems from the complexity of bacterial pathogenesis, because Yersinia pestis doesn't just passively bump into cells, it actively orchestrates its uptake.
It's got a game plan.
Exactly. And prior to this study, the exact human genetic variants and the specific host receptors that facilitated this highly targeted entry into distinct immune cell populations, well, they were largely a black box.
Okay, let's unpack this, because finding one specific entry node for a complex bacterium across the entire human genome requires some serious analytical power. Let's think of the human cell as a fortress. We know viruses have picked the locks, but we haven't found the specific lock picked by the plague bacteria. So how did they do it?
Well, the team utilized this really innovative platform called HiHost. That stands for High Throughput Human In Vitro Susceptibility Testing.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's basically a pandemic in a plate approach. They ran a cellular genome-wide association study, AgileLS, across nearly 1,000 different genomes.
1,000, that is a massive screening.
It really is an elegant solution to a logistical nightmare. because obviously you cannot expose a large human cohort to the plague just to observe genetic resistance.
No, definitely not getting ethical approval for that.
Right. So instead, they utilized lymphoblastoid cell lines, or LCLs.
Okay, LCLs, what are those exactly?
They're essentially immortalized human B cells. They use the Epstein-Barr virus to immortalize them, and they source these from highly diverse global populations.
Gotcha. But wait, let me push back on that a little bit. Why use immortalized B cells in a dish instead of, say, actual human tissue? Are they really a good stand-in for the dynamic human body?
It's a fair question, and it's one researchers always grapple with. While immortalized cells in a controlled environment definitely lack the dynamic interplay of a whole immune system, using B cells as the primary screening model is actually a brilliant choice here.
How so?
Well, B cells natively reside heavily in the lymphatic system. Think about how the plague starts. A flea bite introduces Yersinia pestis into the dermal tissue, right?
Right.
And from there, the bacteria immediately drain into the regional lymph nodes.
Oh, and that is exactly where the characteristic buboes of the bubonic plague form.
Precisely. So evaluating B-cell susceptibility directly mirrors the earliest, most critical battlefield of the infection. Plus, by standardizing the cell type in an in vitro environment, they can screen thousands of distinct genetic backgrounds simultaneously.
Keeping the environment identical, so the only variable is the host genetics.
Exactly. They expose them all to the exact same pathogenic pressure. But then they needed a way to quantify exactly how successful the bacteria were at invading these diverse B cell lines.
Right, because you have to actually measure the invasion to get any data.
Yep. To do this, they deployed a highly refined version of something called a gentamicin protection assay, and they coupled it with an inducible green fluorescent protein, or a GFP tag, on the bacteria itself.
The mechanics of that assay are just fascinating, because for our listeners, gentamicin is an antibiotic, right?
Yes, an aminoglycoside antibiotic.
And its key characteristic in this context is that it cannot penetrate the lipid bilayer of a living cell membrane.
That impermeability is the absolute cornerstone of the assay. So here's what they do. They introduce the tagged Yersinia pestis to the LCLs and allow some time for infection to happen.
Okay, so the bacteria are swarming the cells.
Right, and then they flood the entire environment with gentamicin.
Just completely wash it in antibiotics.
Yes. So any bacteria remaining in the extracellular fluid or even just clinging to the exterior surface of the B cell, they get completely eradicated.
Wow, so the only bacteria that survive
are the ones that successfully breach the cell membrane and hid inside.
That is so clever. And at that point, they trigger the transcription of that GFP tag you mentioned, causing only the living intracellular bacteria to glow green.
Exactly, they just light up. And running those cells through a flow cytometer allows lasers to count thousands of individual cellular events per second.
So the fluorescence intensity just becomes a direct quantitative measure of infectivity for that specific genetic cell line. It is a brilliant way to turn a messy biological interaction into hard statistical data.
It really is. And that statistical data is what powers the GWS. By comparing the infectivity rates across those 1,000 different cell lines, and then cross-referencing those rates with the sequenced genomes of the original donors, the team isolated a highly significant signal.
They found the needle in the haystack.
They did. They mapped the variation in bacterial entry to a specific single-letter genetic mutation, a non-synonymous SNP called RS228228A4.
Just a single base pair change out of 3 billion. That is incredible. And this specific SNP results in a missense mutation in the gene coding for a surface protein called FCRL3. Right. Specifically, it's the N721S variant.
Spot on. It changes an asparagine amino acid to a serine at position 721. And FCRL3 is an FC receptor-like protein. It's mainly found on the surface of B cells, and its usual physiological role involves sensing the environment, binding to antibodies, and regulating the activation state of the B cell.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because finding the correlation is just the first step, right? Establishing the physical mechanism requires isolating the variable.
Absolutely.
So to prove that FCRL3 was the actual literal conduit for the plague, the researchers took HeLa cells. And normally, HeLa cells do not have FCRL3 on their surface. They're like an immunological blank slate in this regard.
Right. Exposing wild-type HeLa cells to Yersinia pestis results in minimal invasion. The bacteria basically just bounce off the exterior.
But then, when the researchers forced the HeLa cells to overexpress the FCRL3 protein on their membranes, suddenly the bacteria started attaching and invading like crazy.
The microscopy data from those experiments is just striking. You can actually see FCRL3 proteins physically clustering together on the cell membrane, actively concentrating right at the precise topological sites where the Yersinia pestis bacteria are making contact.
So the receptor is literally gathering around the bacteria. That active recruitment suggests the bacteria are doing more than just finding an open door, right? They are actively manipulating the receptor.
Oh, without a doubt. The structural biology reveals that the bacteria physically bind directly to the extracellular domain of the FCRL proteins. Specifically, they utilize a region known as the Ig-like domain 1.
Okay, so the bacteria dock onto Ig-like domain 1. What happens next?
Well, the binding to that domain acts as a mechanical trigger. FCRL3 is a transmembrane protein. So when the outside is bound, it induces a shape change, a conformational change that propagates all the way down through the cell membrane to the intracellular tail.
The part of the protein that dangles inside the cell.
Exactly. And that tail contains highly conserved signaling motifs known as ITAMs and ITAMs.
These are basically molecular alarms,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. They are critical docking sites for intracellular enzymes. When that ITAM is triggered, it recruits a kinase called SYK to the inner membrane surface.
And SYK is a massive regulatory node.
Huge. Its activation triggers a cascade that ultimately leads to the rapid rearrangement of actin filaments just beneath the cell membrane.
So the bacteria are essentially operating the cell's own machinery by remote control.
Yes. By binding the external domain, they force those internal motifs to recruit SYK, which polymerizes the actin, causing the cell membrane to physically reach up, engulf the bacteria, and pull it inside.
Wow. They don't have to force their way in at all. They literally trick the cell into swallowing them.
Exactly. And interestingly, they also found some redundancy. A structurally similar receptor, FCRL5, can trigger a similar engulfment pathway, so the bacteria have backup routes.
Okay, so watching SYK pull the bacteria inside solves the structural mystery of the normal infection.
Mm-hmm.
But it brings us back to that specific genetic mutation, the N721S variant, the substitution of a serine for an asparagine at position 721. That happens precisely in that intracellular signaling tail, right?
It does, and that single amino acid substitution disrupts the entire cascade. Asparagine has an amide side chain, while serine has a hydroxyl group.
Which sounds like a tiny difference.
It is tiny, but that subtle biochemical shift alters the whole conformational landscape of that tail. So the bacteria can still successfully bind to the external Ig-like domain.
But the alarm never goes off inside.
Exactly. The intracellular signal to recruit SYK kinase is severely blunted. The actin never polymerizes, the membrane never reaches out, and the bacterium is just left stranded outside the cell.
Incredible. And this is where the scope of the study just expands dramatically.
All right.
Because the researchers took this precise N721S mutation, the one that leaves the plague stranded, and they cross-referenced it with the BioBank Japan database.
Right. They analyze hundreds of distinct human phenotypes and disease states.
And the results are staggering. It turns out, this exact same mutation is associated with a markedly reduced risk of chronic hepatitis C infection.
A massive, complex bacterium and a small RNA virus both converging on the exact same immunological bottleneck. It's wild.
It really is. It's like, think of FCRL3 as a corrupt bouncer at a nightclub. The plague bacteria hands the bouncer a fake ID. The bouncer accepts it, groups his team around the bacteria, and just escorts it straight into the VIP lounge, which is the inside of the B cell.
I love that analogy.
Right. But the mutation changes the bouncer's behavior. The fake ID is still handed over at the door, but the bouncer just stands there. The VIP door is never open. And it turns out that same bouncer is keeping hepatitis C out of the club, too.
It is a remarkable convergence of evolutionary biology and modern virology. Hepatitis C typically utilizes a complex web of classical entry factors. The fact that an alteration in FCRL3 signaling severely hampers its ability to establish chronicity suggests that this pathway is a previously unrecognized yet critical co-regulatory node for viral persistence.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the evolutionary ecology of this interaction is fascinating. Yersinia pestis is an evolutionarily young pathogen, right?
It is. It diverged from Yersinia pseudotuberculosis, which is a relatively mild stomach bug that just causes gastroenteritis.
And the study showed that pseudotuberculosis does not use this FCRL3 backdoor.
Correct. The capacity to specifically hijack this B-cell receptor is an evolutionary innovation entirely specific to the highly virulent Yersinia pestis.
But why target a B-cell at all? I mean, if you are an invading pathogen, seeking refuge inside a white blood cell seems tactically flawed. You're walking right into the immune system's command center.
It definitely appears counterintuitive, but it makes perfect sense when you view it through the lens of the safe harbor theory.
The safe harbor theory.
Yeah, so the immune system is heavily compartmentalized. You have professional phagocytes, primarily neutrophils and macrophages, which constantly patrol the tissue.
A heavy artillery.
Exactly. Their sole biological purpose is to engulf foreign bodies and immediately subject them to a lethal barrage of reactive oxygen species and acids. You do not want to be caught by a neutrophil before your own pathogenic defenses are ready.
Okay, so neutrophils are the immediate danger, but B cells aren't.
Right. B cells are lymphocytes focused on adaptive immunity and antibody production. They are not professional killers in the same immediate destructive sense.
I see.
By deliberately slipping inside a B cell, the plague bacteria rapidly removes itself from the extracellular space, effectively hiding from the radar of those lethal neutrophils.
So the B cell becomes a taxicab. The bacteria locks itself safely inside a cell that is naturally migrating toward the lymph nodes anyway. It gets a free, secure ride directly to where it wants to go, replicates safely, forms the bubo, and eventually bursts out.
It is an evolutionary masterstroke. Using the very cells meant to coordinate the immune response as a protective shield during its most vulnerable phase.
But wait, if the N721S mutation, this protective C allele, disrupts this Trojan horse dynamic and protects against both the plague and hepatitis C, its selective advantage seems immense. Yet if I recall from the paper, the global frequency of this protective allele is only about 6%.
Yeah, roughly 6%.
If it provides such a profound defense, why isn't it more common? Why hasn't it swept through the entire human population?
That low frequency points directly to balancing selection. Evolution is an uncompromising accountant, you know? Every adaptation carries a systemic cost. FCRL3 is not just an arbitrary doorway. It is a vital regulatory node that sets the activation threshold for B cells.
So if you tweak the receptor to lock out a pathogen, you're simultaneously messing with how that B cell responds to normal immune signals.
Exactly, and the clinical data bears that out. Other genetic variations within the FCRL3 gene that alter its signaling capacity are strongly linked to a heightened risk for severe autoimmune disorders.
Like rheumatoid arthritis, right?
Yes, and Graves' disease. The immune system requires exquisite calibration. A mutation that fortifies the cell against an infection might lower the threshold for autoreactivity, causing the B cells to inappropriately attack the host's own tissues.
Oh, wow. So that 6% frequency is just the evolutionary tightrope walk between infectious disease susceptibility and autoimmune self-destruction.
Perfectly stated.
It's a phenomenal demonstration of how interconnected our cellular networks are. But, you know, as comprehensive as this cellular GWS and all these biochemical validations are, mapping these interactions in immortalized cells in a plastic dish fundamentally isolates the variables. What's missing here? What are the limitations?
The authors are very objective about this. While LCLs and HeLa cells beautifully elucidate the core molecular mechanism, the binding, the SYK recruitment, they operate in a vacuum, they are devoid of the complex cytokine signaling and tissue architecture of a living organism.
Right, it's not the native environment.
So the next logical step necessitates moving from these in vitro models to primary human immune cells or well-calibrated animal models. We need to see how this FCRL3-mediated entry actually alters the global immune response in vivo.
To see this Trojan horse dynamic in a living, breathing system.
Exactly. Validating this in a complete biological system will determine whether this mechanism can eventually be targeted pharmacologically.
The insights extracted from this research really profoundly shift our biological perspective.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to summarize, human genetic variation has revealed that the devastating plague bacteria, Yersinia pestis, directly hijacks FCRL immune receptors to invade B lymphocytes, likely establishing a safe harbor during early infection. And remarkably, the exact same genetic variant that impedes this ancient bacterial invasion also offers modern protection against the hepatitis C virus.
It underscores that our immunological architecture is just a historical record shaped by ancient pandemics, leaving biological fingerprints that still dictate our modern vulnerabilities.
What does this mean for how we view our immune cells? Not just as defenders, but as potential accomplices that shape our susceptibility to both ancient plagues and modern viruses. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe to your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
the steps till the noise feels tame. If it's real, it repeats the same. From Nosk to the sheet of light, same sample, different sight. I don't chase a myth, I chase what's true. Numbers that hold when you push them through, 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 through. Run it again, let it show what it shows. Clear as the curve when the data flows. 4.343 in the glow. Benchmarks like a compass where the wild winds blow. Run it again, if it stands, we'll know. Benchmarks like a compass where the wild winds blow.